Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Mike Johnson, director of communities and technology at MassTLC. Welcome, Mike.
Hello. Good afternoon. Great.
Great. So let's get started. Tell us a little bit about what is MassTLC and what do you do there?
So MassTLC is the region's largest tech trade association. So basically we have 500 member companies that are all tech companies, and our job is to basically connect them all. So big companies to small companies to big companies, CTOs to CTOs, and everywhere in between. So we want to network everyone and build a collective wisdom amongst everyone, because everyone's trying to, you know, get where they're going. And you can get there a lot faster if you know everyone sort of in the scene.
Yeah, excellent. And MassTLC has definitely helped me out in multiple ways in terms of making those connections, especially early on when you're starting out, you're a new company, you're a new founder, you have pretty much zero connections, especially if you're new to the city. So MassTLC was awesome for that.
Yeah, my job's great. All I need to do is introduce people and go make people happy and shake hands and send emails.
So is that the main part of your job? Is that the director of communities piece of it?
What about
the director of technology piece of it? Is that a new
piece? Yes. That's a new piece. That has to do with me being able to fix printers, install drivers. And we recently launched a new website that is a total shift from our traditional website. So our traditional website was basically just essentially a B2B website that was, hey, come join MassTLC. Okay. And essentially after you joined MassTLC, you didn't really have a reason to come back to it. Mm-hmm. So we decided to sort of flip the idea of what most trade association websites look like on its head. And it's totally a content platform now for promoting what our members are doing. So we really want to, you know, amplify all the cool stuff that's happening in our community.
That's great. I'll have to check that out.
Yes.
Has it been released yet? And I'm just behind on that.
Okay. Released it a week and a half ago.
Oh, okay. So I'm not too behind.
Yeah. So that was a special project of mine.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm cool. I that's very cool. And I'm excited to check that out. Yeah. So why don't we dive right in to talking about technology, but particularly because it's MassTLC, Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council. Let's talk about Boston, just to kind of start with, and then we can sort of expand the umbrella to further away. So what would you say from your vantage point is the most exciting thing that's going on in Boston Tech right now?
There's a couple big things that are happening in Boston Tech. IoT is a huge thing that's blowing up. Then security is another thing that's really making waves around here. And then there's a lot of, you know, traditional software companies that are just, you know, producing, you know, software that everyone needs, whether it's, you know, e-commerce, or, you know, marketing technology. There's a lot of AI going on. MassTLC just helped Mass Robotics launched down in the seaport. So there's a lot of robotics companies. iRobot came out of here. Mm-hmm. There's Vecna that's over in Cambridge. So robotics is a huge industry, and I think that plays a lot into the IoT really growing out of here.
Yeah, it's a good point that you make giving all of those examples, because I think when most people, I don't want to stereotype, but I think when most people think of tech, they think of software companies.
Yes.
And while they're playing a huge role in changing the world and making the world a better place, sometimes folks forget about the Internet of Things and the robotics and the security and that kind of stuff. And that they're so more of the hardware, the actual things, as opposed to the software.
Yes. But even the hardware companies will say that, you know, most of the hardware is software, that, you know, robotics is, you know, 10% hardware and 90% software.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm stealing that from Daniel Theobald, the CTO of Vecna.
Okay. Okay. So all companies, even hardware companies, and especially hardware companies, are software companies.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I heard that from Smart Bear. The just basically the idea that no matter what industry you're in, whether it's more tech E, or even if it's not, like companies like Capital One mm-hmm. that have come out and said that, yeah, we're a software company above anything, above everything else.
Yeah. A lot of the financial companies like State Street are getting into blockchain. So that's really interesting. And even a company that nobody realizes is around here, Shark Ninja. So your vacuum cleaners and your blenders is located right out of, you know, down the street in Newton. Mm-hmm. You know, they're getting into it because they need to have, you know, IoT blenders now. So, you know, your smoothies can make themselves. and Keurig, which is up in Burlington right near our office, you know, building cool things, you know, out of there that are all connected devices.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about IoT. So I know, what do I know about IoT? I know that it stands for the Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. I know that it basically can essentially make your kitchen and the rest of your house interconnected with one another. You know, and so I guess, so with things like the Amazon Alexa and the Google Home, those things would fall into IoT, right?
Yep.
So those would probably be examples that people are most aware of. And then the stuff on the, maybe on more of the fringes, is the stuff like the blender that can talk to the toaster or things like that. I mean, is that just like joking, or is that like for real, like that the whole interconnected kitchen, let's say, for example?
When most people outside of the tech industry think of IoT, they think of the connected homes. Yep. But there's a lot more to IoT. Vesper Technology, who participated in NewCo last week, talked about their microphones and putting their microphones on cows, so they could tell if the cow was sick. Okay. So that's a connected device mm-hmm. that would feed back, and you'd be like, hey, you know, this microphone is telling me that my cow isn't breathing right, or its pulse has gone up or down. Yeah. I should go check on this. So that's a connected device. Then there's, you know, sensors that go on pipes underground that say, hey, you know, this pipe has a leak in it. We should go check this out. Mm-hmm. There's street lamps that, you know, automatically turn on and off. So smart cities is a huge, mm-hmm. huge part of IoT. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, pretty much every lamppost around here is connected due to partnerships with Verizon and Cisco mm-hmm. That are just monitoring traffic, or, you know, putting out cell signals. So pretty much everything around here is connected nowadays. You just don't realize it. But when people think of IoT, they think of, you know, the connected toaster.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course. And we think of ourselves, right? We think of our homes. Or
yeah.
That's a great example. Or those are great examples of things that are not in our homes. You know, the yes. farm tech and the city tech and that kind of thing. Yeah. You mentioned security earlier, and so I'm wondering, when we're thinking about a more interconnected world, do you think that makes things more or less secure?
It's a little bit of both. I think the world has traditionally been very insecure, but, you know, people haven't really taken advantage of it. But now, you know, there's more money out there if you're willing to take advantage of insecure things mm-hmm. or unsecure things. So, you know, people are doing these things. But with all these technologies out there, you can trace where all these things are happening, and you can lock down things faster. So if you discover that, you know, there's been a breach, you can lock it down, and hopefully you can trace back to where it happened. You know, unfortunately, once, you know, you've been breached, you know, the data's gone, whatever they've gotten. Yeah. But, you know, it's unfortunately just a fact of life now that, you know, everyone's going to be exposed to some sort of data breach. You know, multiple times a year, you'll probably get a notification that, you know, something that you participate in, whether it's a credit card or someplace that you shop at, or, you know, your alma mater, you know, has been breached. I was listening to something on the radio where they were asking, you know, university students, how many times a day do you think your university is attacked? Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, I don't know, like 3, 4, 5, 6. And the number, I believe, was 80,000, that, you know, universities get 80,000 attacks a day. And, you know, that's just through, you know, phishing emails, and other various attacks, just because there's so much information in there. And, you know, it's information, research information that's, you know, valuable to, you know, foreign nations. And then it's also just personal information, because they've got not only student information, but they've got all the alumni information. They've got, mm-hmm. you know, all of the employee information out there as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's a really important lens through which to view things, especially as a former academic, as a former employee of a university who used to get frustrated at all of the levels of security that, you know, you having to log into the system constantly in order to like get access to student data and stuff like that. But it is that's information that we don't want the wrong people to get their hands on. You know, we're not just talking about students' grades and what courses they're interested in taking next semester, right? We're talking about their social security numbers, their addresses, their parents' names, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of that is within a university's data system.
And it's so easy to get into via phishing, because everything looks official. And, you know, thankfully, you know, kids are pretty email blind nowadays, but you know, a lot of, you know, being an academic, you know, you get emails and you feel like you have to open every email.
Yeah.
So you open it and it looks official. So you click on it and then all of a sudden someone's in. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's Mimecast had a presentation the other day where they were showing a new commercial that they had done. And it was the person that invited us out there was their head of global acquisition. And he was joking that the commercial talked about how the company had gotten breached, the hypothetical company in the commercial had gotten breached because a recruiter had opened an email attachment from a potential new hire.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's how the, you know, hacker had gotten access into it.
Yeah. Scary stuff, but I guess if you look at it from the perspective, it's not about if you're going to get hacked, it's about when.
Yeah.
And so putting the necessary precautions, both from like an organizational level, whether it's colleges or universities and companies and organizations, but also us individually as well.
Yeah. There were two interesting things that I realized the other day that for like the big data hacks that you hear about that you're like, how did someone get inside, you know, a huge government, you know, complex? One of the things that people will do is they'll drop USB sticks, like huge, like high dollar value ones, like 128 gig ones that, you know, they're not nearly as valuable as they used to be, mm-hmm. but like big, you know, size ones. And people are like, oh, I just found this, you know,
yeah.
And they'll put it in their pocket and they'll be like, oh, I'll just wipe this and keep it.
Oh, wow.
And then when they go to do that, they'll get into it. And then the other thing that people do is they put up open networks. So this is something you'll see if you go to like a security conference, that someone always does this, is they'll put an open network up and they'll, you know, when they go to give their presentation, they'll be like, okay, who signed into the open network? Uh-huh. And people will be like, oh no. And then they'll just start bringing up people's data from their phones.
Oh, wow.
Because as soon as you sign into an open network, you're exchanging packets with, you know, this router.
Yeah. And so that kind of thing, though, is to prove a point. It's not to be malicious, right?
Yep.
It's just so don't do that.
Yep.
You know, I'm going to give you your data back, right?
Yep.
You know, but just realize that kind of thing.
And just how easy it is.
Right. Exactly. Wow. All right. I do want to shift the conversation to some other topics, although it was awesome talking about security stuff. So let's talk a little bit about hiring in the tech world. And I know that this is something that you've been sort of in and out of, kind of involved in, kind of maybe not as much now. But one of the things that I'm curious about, especially from my vantage point, you know, doing what I do and helping the tech managers to build better teams and talking to tech managers, a lot of them complain basically that it's so hard to hire for mid to higher level positions. Junior level engineers, there's a lot of great talent. It's pretty relatively easy to hire for those kinds of things. But as soon as you start talking about more leadership positions, like a tech lead or a software engineering manager or a director or VP or something like that, it just becomes insanely hard to hire. I'm wondering if you've heard the same thing and what your thoughts might be on this.
Oh, 100%. That's the thing I hear from absolutely everyone. And if you want to hire one of these people, you're going to pay through the nose for them. And if you're a person looking to move, you've pretty much got your pick of the litter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great place to be in if you're looking to move, and a terrible place to be in if you're looking to hire.
So
I've heard of companies doing everything and anything to hire people. I've heard of companies moving into the city because, you know, they hear that, you know, the aging generation is, you know, once their kids, you know, move out of the house, they're, you know, moving back into the city. And they're like, oh, you know, maybe I'll be able to get some of these, you know, senior leaders there. Mm-hmm. And then I've heard of companies saying, hey, you know what, we got to move out of the city. Because all of these people, you know, the mid-level people are starting families, and, you know, that last 5 miles into the city is an hour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't want to drive that, you know, that extra hour. Mm-hmm. So it's a big question, but I will tell you that I've seen a lot of companies reopening offices in the 128 belt again. Mm-hmm. So there was a big push to go back into the city a couple of years ago. And I think you're going to start seeing the, you know, the tech belt back in 128,
yeah,
blowing back up again.
So why do you think this is the case? I mean, certainly there's probably multiple factors that play into why it's so hard and why companies have to pay through the nose to get good talent in those kinds of positions. But why do you think that is? What are some of the reasons?
I don't think anyone developed a really great like upskilling program. So that, you know, there's engineers out there, but I don't think people really, you know, built a solid transition plan. Mm-hmm. So they're engineers, but there's no next level. And then some of those people that are engineers don't want to be managers.
That's right.
So, you know, some people are just want to be coders. They just want to sit in their cube. They want to work their 9 to 5, do their pager shift, you know, do their rotation every once in a while and be done with it. They don't want to deal with people, you know, and it takes a special kind of person that can both, you know, hack code and, you know, deal with personalities.
Yep. Exactly. And I think, like you said earlier, it's depending on which perspective you're looking at it from. If you look at it from the perspective of the company, it's okay. This is really, really hard, and mm-hmm. we have to pay a lot. But if you're the perspective of, you know, let's say you're an engineering manager with 5-10 years experience and you're looking to either move up or move on or move to a different city, then that should be a happy world for those people, right? Where they could get paid top dollar or even above what their wildest dreams, even in some cases, just because it's, okay, you have this experience, you can do a really, really good job here. And we, from the company's perspective, we may get, you know, say four resumes in or four potential folks, but only one of them may be the one that we would even want to hire.
Yeah.
So from their perspective, you know, from the managers and the directors who have that experience, it should be, life should be easy. But from my perspective, it's not always what the case is, though, that they don't always necessarily see it that way.
Yeah.
So it's good to hear this perspective.
Yeah. I think one of the other historical issues was that, you know, so many of the companies around here grew so fast that they didn't have time to take their engineers sort of out of, you know, coding mode and give them, you know, time to develop as managers. You know, if you were, you know, a 10X programmer, like they were going to have you code all day. Mm-hmm. Like there was no, you know, bringing in management consultants or, you know, putting you under, you know, your manager's wing. It was code all day till you go home, you know, mm-hmm. get up in the morning, code, yeah. Get the product out, start releasing more code.
Right.
So.
Right. It's eat, think, code, sleep.
Yeah.
Repeat.
Yeah. And if you're not doing that, then you're not being productive, and it's time to get someone else productive in.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have an inkling of a desire, but also an inkling of the skills to be able to work with a team of people and not be 100% tactical anymore, but move into the strategic, you know, that's really what,
yeah,
that's a really nice skill set, to have.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think for a long time, management was left to like the scrum masters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like project management kind of thing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But now, they still exist. You know, project management isn't going away. At least I don't see it is. Yeah. But there's a sort of new breed of manager that's not project manager. That's the, I'm the manager of the team of geeks that writes the code that, you know, is staying up all night, but really shouldn't be staying up all night. Because if you heard about this thing called burnout and yes. all of this stuff that there's just more of a need and lots of folks out there filling that need to sort of say, okay, you used to be an engineer and now you're managing engineers. This is not just a career change. You know, it is a promotion in some ways, right? But it's a complete career shift almost in terms of the way that you think about the work that you do.
Yeah. And it's essentially for a lot of people giving up what they've done their whole time. Because once you're out of the code for, you know, maybe it's a year, maybe it's, you know, a year and a half, things change so fast that, you know, you're obsolete. And if it turns out after a year and a half, you don't like being a manager anymore, mm-hmm. you got to go retrain yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard.
Yeah, and so to a certain extent, you have to be okay with falling behind the curve mm-hmm. because the curve moves so fast.
Yeah.
Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So let's talk about money. Let's talk about pay transparency, because I know this is a topic that you have indicated before that you're interested in. So let's start at the very basic. What does pay transparency mean to you? When I say that term, what comes to mind?
Pay transparency means wondering if what people put on Glassdoor is accurate.
Yeah.
So uh-huh. I think everyone wants to believe what Glassdoor says, you know, the average, you know, software developer earns or the average customer success manager earns is what people actually earn in that region. Mm-hmm. But nobody actually knows. Yeah. And I still think it comes down to, you know, people aren't comfortable negotiating. Like when you go into, you know, an interview and you get the job and you feel really good and you get the offer, like even in a super hot market, you know, it still takes some gusto to push back and be like, I want more money.
Yep.
Especially if you like, you know, where you might potentially be moving to.
Oh, like if it's a new area.
Yeah.
Like
a new company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the culture is there. You don't know. You don't want to come off as arrogant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you don't want to start off on the wrong foot.
Right. Exactly. But you're sort of tying it to what we were talking about before. You know, if you know the situation, if you know that you're probably one of the only qualified people, not only qualified, but like we really, really want to hire you. Like if you could see it from that perspective, like as soon as they say, or even the organization has some sort of interest in you, like, you know, we want to move forward with you. We want to bring you to another interview. The light bulb should start going off in your head saying, wow, they really want to hire me. But when you're in it, when you're in that situation, right, it's hard. It's hard to negotiate.
Yeah.
It's hard to communicate your value because it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for everybody.
I don't know anyone besides maybe like superstar sales reps that have come out of interviews saying, I've got this job. I'm the best. Like, they're going to hire me and I'm going to ask for $1 million a year. Mm-hmm. I think most people come out of interviews fairly humble.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think it's a humbling experience, even if you have a sense of, oh, you know what? I think maybe I'm the only one they're considering. I don't know. Maybe that can't be it, though. No. There must be other people on the list. And And because it's a humbling experience to, like, put all that stuff on paper and to come up with, oh, and this is what I've done. But it wasn't just me, really. And what picture should I paint? You know, yeah. How much of it was me? How much was it my team? How much did I just get lucky? That kind of thing. But you had mentioned earlier there was a story that you had about a friend or a colleague that is sort of around pay transparency.
Yeah. So I had a friend that was a, you know, senior architect or chief architect or whatever title they wanted to give him, but had no one under him. And when he decided it was time for him to leave, you know, everything was fine the first week. You know, of the 2-week notice. And then at the end of the first week, he got an offer, of a ridiculous amount of money, over $250,000 a year to stay. And then he turned it down because he knew it was just time to go. He wasn't interested in solving the problem anymore. He wanted to manage people. And he knew that was the next step that he wanted to take.
Yeah.
And then he showed up on, you know, the next Monday and was offered an extra $100,000 check that day to stay for a year.
Yeah.
You know, he could walk out, you know, essentially with $400,000 for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was enough money to pay off a house.
Yep.
And still, like, his heart wasn't in it. And once you reach a certain pay grade, like, it doesn't matter. The money doesn't matter. And at some point, like, offering so much money is a red flag. So, like, it's like a girlfriend situation or a boyfriend situation when they're just so desperate for you.
Yes.
That you're just like, something's not right here. Like, I need to go away. Like, this is going to turn into like a Lifetime movie.
Right. And that what's going on in there? What's going on in their head? What are their expectations for me?
Yes.
If they're so desperate, you know, I may have had a big win in the past, but that was partially due to luck. And I don't know that I can promise that again. And what's going to happen? I don't want that.
Yeah.
That pressure, but also, yeah, red flag for other reasons.
Yeah.
Too.
And who wants to be the person that is just working for the paycheck?
That's right.
You know, you want to be the person that's working for passion.
That's right. And so the psychology of that is really interesting, where past a certain point, and even to a certain point where you're doing something because you're internally motivated to do it, you don't need the rewards. The rewards can actually be demotivating. They actually, no, don't give me any money. Don't do this because that's going to make me feel, I don't know, dirty or whatever word you want to attach with it, right? That like, this is, I want to do this for me. This is my labor of love. Let it be that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. And that same friend's like the most successful project he worked on for that organization. He did it over a weekend because he just came up with this idea. And, you know, we stayed up for 2 days just packing away at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just, you know, the way he worked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to this idea of pay transparency and maybe look at it from a different perspective. So when we started talking about it, you had said, well, it's pay transparency is essentially what is on Glassdoor. Is that reality or not? And how do we know that? So when you think about, like, if you think about the hiring process, I've seen some articles and I've seen some folks talking about, like, at what point during the hiring process should salary be talked about? Do you have any thoughts on that? Any experience with that with regard to this pay transparency conversation?
I love when I go onto sites and see what the dollar amount is before you even apply.
Mm, like on the online, like the job
yeah.
ad. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And traditionally, it's only government jobs that you see that on.
Yep.
And there are a couple that I saw the other day on, like, Referral Mob that had the pay on there.
Yep.
But it, with so many weird job titles out there nowadays, it's really hard to figure out, like, where you're at when you're applying for a job. You know, chief rock star, chief ninja, sales...
Yeah.
Sales enabler, sales ninja.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's just.
What does that mean?
Yes. And every company, it means something different.
Mm-hmm.
I think people kind of know where they are in their career based on a salary. As weird as that sounds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
It's at least a range.
Yeah.
Right. You know, within, you know, 10 to 20% or something like
yes.
that.
Yes. And like, you know, the size of the company, you're like, oh, this company pays well. So, you know, maybe I'm six figures at this company. Maybe I'm, you know, high five figures at this other company. Right. But like, you might know if you're like a $75,000 employee at one company, you're not a $150,000 employee at another company.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so from that perspective, it would be nice to just see the number, or at least the range of the numbers on,
yes.
on the job ad from the get go.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But do you think, are there positive and negatives to that though? Like would it be better or worse to not do that from like, say, the company's perspective, to maybe not pigeonhole themselves into a particular.
I think companies have their own range anyways, and they're also using so many filters to get out the bad applicants before they even hit the desk anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you might be getting at is that if you post a job that's, you know, say it's $150,000 a year, you might get 10x the amount of applications if people know it's $150,000 a year job.
Right.
But chances are you're using, you know, some sort of software that's gonna, you know, pull out most of the bad seeds before you even see them anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're hopefully paying, you know, recruiters to pull those out before they get there anyways.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is a good point, that most of them have a number in mind anywhere, or at least a range, that this is what's in the budget, or this is how much wiggle room there is, and why not show the cards? Why not show it?
Like, you're going to get to it anyways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's an interesting conversation. It's an interesting topic, and I for one am curious to see what happens with it, especially given more and more companies like Rent the Runway and others who are being transparent about pay and creating models to be transparent about pay.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think also in Massachusetts now, I believe it might just be Massachusetts, that employers can no longer ask what you're currently earning at your
mm-hmm.
position.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a real, real nice thing for the potential employee sake.
Yes.
That, you know, say you're a $75,000 employee and you're going for a $100,000 job.
Yeah.
They can't lower what they were going to pay you based on what you're currently earning.
Yep. Yeah. That's good, and that empowers the job seekers.
Yeah, and I think pay transparency is nice too. When there's, you know, such sort of a pushback on equal pay, let's say from the top, that if it's put out there now, it's better for equality. If
yeah.
you know, if people know this job is, you know, $75,000 to $85,000, that you're going to get $75,000 to $85,000 no matter, you know, what gender, race, creed you are.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another great benefit of it. The more transparent we are, the more equal we can be, because we know what equality, we know what it looks like. We've defined the playing field. So, okay, now we know what we need to do in order to fix it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. So the last question that I have for you is a question that I ask everyone on my podcast. And that is, what is the biggest people related challenge in your job?
The greatest people-related challenge in my job. I think it's reaching the right people. So my job is to basically get the message out. We do a lot of events. I have to find people to speak at my events and basically just spread the gospel of Mass TLC.
Sure.
And we have a couple people at most companies that are big advocates for us. But, you know, I need to cast a wide net. And people are hit with so many different messages all the time. So yeah. it's tricky for me to, you know, go deep in a company. So that's really one of the things that I've been working on. I think it's actually a hot topic in talent in general, is the whole aspect of customer success. So making sure that, you know, everyone is sort of using your product to its fullest capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So Mass TLC essentially is a product, and, you know, we sell corporate memberships. So no matter if one person in your organization uses the membership, or, you know, 500 people use the membership,
yeah.
you know, it's the same price.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make sure that everyone in the organization is using the membership. So I want to, you know, reach out and make sure all these people know what's available to them, that, you know, they're getting the professional development or, you know, connecting with the right people.
Got it. So I'd imagine in your efforts to spread the gospel, you've perhaps toyed with different communication methods like email or Slack, or I use Facebook messaging right now for my business, and I never thought I would do that. So have you played with different communication toys? Do some, or tools, I guess you'd say, do some seem better or worse? Or
yeah. So I started a Slack channel for our CTOs. I started one for talent. But early adoption was great, and then it sort of dwindled off because I think people have so many Slack things going on.
Yeah.
Then we've always had a LinkedIn community that's just sort of general. That seems to do okay. Mm-hmm. We've recently been doing more Facebook ads,
yeah.
Which is interesting because the woman that runs our marketing is young. She's 24, 25, doesn't have a Facebook account. So it's funny that Facebook skews older for us. But our last campaign did fairly well on Facebook, getting people out to our NewCo event.
Yeah.
So I think it's just sort of figuring out our internal marketing strategy. And I think our new web platform is going to be a better way of doing it. We're not trying to replace something like a Bostino or BBJ. We want to be a source for those sort of publications to say, you know, so they don't have to really dig around. They can just come to us and be like, oh, they're doing this cool thing. Let's, you know, steal this article, or, you know, dig a little bit deeper on it.
Got it. Got it. And one more question that I have, this may be like sort of going deeper into sort of the making connections and the whole networking thing. But one of the things that I've been geeking out about lately, which is very micro in terms of workflow kinds of things, is I guess what you would call it the art of the follow-up. So sort of like following up with people. When do you follow up? How do you follow up? How do you determine whether or not to follow up? And again, I imagine just in sort of in a community builder and a connector and somebody who networks a lot, that this may be something that you've toyed around with or that have some thoughts on.
Yeah, so I use a tool called Boomerang.
Okay.
For specific things when I'm like, oh, you know, I need to make sure that I hear back from this person. And basically, it dumps things back into your inbox if you haven't heard from them. But there is a little bit of, you know, the first date anxiety. Sometimes when you meet people, like, how soon do I follow up with them? I don't want to,
exactly,
you know, be too eager.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I just met this person. Do I ask them to speak on something right now? Or, you know, where do I slot them in? And yeah, then sometimes I'm like, oh, this person's great. Where can I slot them in? Do I do an event specifically for them? Like, if you meet someone that's just like an amazing person,
yeah,
like you know that you need to share their knowledge with the community. Like, do I do a webinar with them? Like, how do I get their word out? And you know, I think a lot of it now is going to be doing, you know, like blog posts or webinars. I think your podcast is an awesome platform, so hopefully I can push people your way and say, like, you gotta talk on this podcast.
Much appreciated. Yeah. So I guess what I hear you saying is it really depends on the situation, right? So if it's someone who is, I really want to connect with this person, I really want to help this person spread their word, then it's, you're perhaps more aggressive, but aggressive in a nice way, right?
Yeah.
Versus if it's like, oh, you know what, like in my situation, like when I think about like who I might follow up with or not, if it's like, well, it doesn't really, I don't need this information right away, and it's not something that it's like, it's not at the top of my priority list, so I might follow up with them in a couple of weeks, or I know that this person typically doesn't email me back for 2 weeks, so I've used Boomerang, and there's other software out there. I use Follow Up CC now, which is very similar to Boomerang. There's just a few more features that are sort of baked in, like it has response notifications, so like when somebody opens an email, I'll know. And so that actually helps. That gives me information to know, okay, you read the email, that's good. I'm not going to bother you for a few days.
I use Sidekick as well. Okay. So if you read my email, I get a little pop-up that you've read it.
Cool.
Which my coworkers think is totally creepy. That, like, you know, whenever, you know, I'm, you know, using the projector and they see all the little pop-ups of everyone reading my email. They're like, you don't think that's creepy? I'm like, no, I need to know when people read my emails.
Yeah, you read my email.
And then I find it really weird when people read emails from like, you know, 2 years ago that I see pop up.
Yeah. Or someone, they must be like, I'll get multiple notifications for the same email. So they must just be like, be going through, like trying to get to inbox zero or something like that. And I'll see it pop up a whole bunch of times. So then you can just turn it off. Like, I know you saw it. I don't need to know that you looked at it 10 times. But yeah, I mean, I guess there is a little bit of the creepy treehouse factor there, but it's also like, if you look at it from like, oh, why don't you try it? You know, I know that it does seem a little bit creepy and, you know, yeah, it's kind of weird that you saw that I read your email, but just try it and see that it actually does help in workflow and in making decisions.
It's a little exciting too, because you're like, ooh, I think they're about to email me. And then all of a sudden you get an email from them and you're like, yes.
That's what's cool. Yes. That's always a nice indication, especially like, again, with the multiple notifications. Like if I see someone, if I send the email, I see they saw it right away. Oh, they're just on email right now. But then like the next day I see a pop up. I'm like, oh, you get the little adrenaline rush. And it's like, oh, maybe they might email me now. Yeah. And then they do. So it's sort of like that. Yeah. I can tell the future.
If it would only tell you when they like put it in like the delete box.
Oh, right. Exactly. When are they ignoring you? Yeah. Right. Exactly. Anyway.
The sentiment click.
Say again?
The sentiment click. That's what you need.
That's like, right.
Then, oh, I can't deal with this person now.
Right, exactly. What are they thinking? Who knows? Yeah. Maybe some software company in Boston will figure that out. Yeah. We'll all be even freaked out more.
Well, there's one thing that we didn't get to that I know we're off of time. So maybe this is a discussion for another guest. But one thing that I've seen a lot lately that's a talent topic is recruiters have been bouncing around, and maybe this has traditionally been something that's happened that I'm just noticing now, but sort of like the top recruiters at a lot of the tech companies have been bouncing around to different companies. And I feel like it's sort of like the financial services industry now, where like the top people like bounce around and sort of take their book of business. So like, if you lose your top recruiter, does that mean that they're going to take your top talent with them?
Oh, interesting. So by bouncing around, you mean the recruiter may be employed by X recruiting firm, but then they leave.
Yeah. So your top internal recruiter.
Yeah. But because that person has spent probably their whole professional career building those relationships with people, they take those relationships with them.
Yes.
And then, so what does that mean for recruiting? What does it mean for the talent hunt, so to speak?
Yeah. You
know, that is interesting.
Yeah. So maybe that's a topic for another day.
Yeah, it's a great suggestion. All right, well, it's been great talking with you, Mike. Appreciate all of your thoughts. And I hope to see what's going on at MassTLC, and I hope to stay connected.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks.
Bye.